The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 92, recorded November 1st, 2012. After the storm. Well, welcome back to another episode of Digital Campus. I'm Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org and at foundhistory on Twitter. All of the regulars are back with me this week. We've got Amanda French from amandafrench.net. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tom.
And Mills Kelly. Mills, you're now on Twitter. I'm correct, right? Edwired Mills.
You gotta catch up, Tom. I've been on Twitter for like weeks.
Oh man. Oh, you're an old timer now. Okay. Mills is at blogs frequently and at length at edwired.org. And Dan Cohen at dancohen.org. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Good. Well, frequent listeners to the podcast might know that we posted our last episode around about the middle of October, and our recording coincided actually with the release of a big court decision concerning Google Books and HathiTrust and the Authors Guild and the publishers, which we didn't get a chance to cover on the last show, and so we're going to do some catching up to start here. In another bit of good news, I think, for digital scholarship and university libraries, the judge in that case decided emphatically for HathiTrust, in favor of HathiTrust and the universities against the Authors Guild, who were claiming that they were that HathiTrust was violating copyright. Judge Harold Baer said in his decision, "I cannot imagine a definition of fair use that would not encompass the transformative uses made by the defendants' mass digitization project, and would require that I terminate this invaluable contribution to the progress of science and cultivation of the arts." Pretty emphatic, I think, and a big victory for supporters of access to university library collections. Dan, you've been following this for years with all of us. What do you think about the decision?
You know, it's just a slam dunk, and I'm not sure any of us really were prepared for this big of a win on the legal front. You know, we've been tracking this since the beginning of this podcast, all the debates over mass digitization of in copyright books, you know, starting obviously with Google and their, you know, 7-year-old fight against the publishers and the Authors Guild. They've, of course, settled with the publishers. The Authors Guild is still fighting. But then more recently, another lawsuit over HathiTrust, which, you know, as the judge recognized fully, completely, was doing something really critical for the advancement of scholarship. And, you know, if you just read through the ruling, I think, the judge saw sort of every piece of fair use in what HathiTrust was doing. It was transformative in that you can do digital humanities text mining on the corpus of books that's been digitized. The judge saw that scholars could find new books and do new search techniques on it. The judge understood that those who are sight impaired would have an easier time with this digitized collection because they'd be able to really use the full library at Michigan and other places audio readers. So just, I mean, across the board, sort of every point that HathiTrust Advance for why one would want a large digital collection of books, including those that are in copyright and orphan works, everything, you know, beyond 1923 that's in a kind of gray area. The judge agreed completely. And so I think this really changes the landscape for what might come, for things like the Digital Public Library of America, which had a meeting the day after this HathiTrust ruling, and there was a lot of sort of chatter at that meeting about what this might mean for the possibility of bringing new digitized books online that are not in the public domain. So I, you know, I think this, along with the Georgia State ruling, the case of Oxford University Press and Cambridge University Press, and I can't remember the third publisher who sued Georgia State for violations of copyright in their e-course reserve packet. And Georgia State won with that, not as completely as HathiTrust, but another solid victory there. I think in the wake of this HathiTrust ruling and the Georgia State ruling, that fair use has been strengthened in the United States. And I think it's going to lead to greater innovation and potentially a new kind of settlement in the overall Google case.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think that that's absolutely right. What is it? I mean, it, the kind of the proximate effect of it, of have, of, you know, HathiTrust being able to move forward with some of its plans to make this collection accessible, is fantastic. But I think the bigger story really is the precedent that's going to be set, by this decision. And as you say, Dan, the Georgia State decision. Mills, do you see it the same way? Is this something, is this going to change the landscape? Are we going to see fewer of these lawsuits or are we going to roll on with these kinds of cases? And, well, really, are we going to be able to continue our podcast?
I'm not sure we're going to be able to continue the podcast, because if everybody settles, then what will we talk about? But at least the legal division of our podcast. But I think until the Google case is fully settled, we'll continue to see suits being filed. But I think once that one's settled, then I think that's sort of the trifecta. You know, with the HathiTrust and the Georgia State decision, as Dan said, if the Google case settles more quickly, which I suspect it might now, then I don't know where there is to go after that.
I actually think, Tom, that in a way it's a good thing that we've had these lawsuits. I can say that since they've come out the way I would like them to. But just, you know, because the thing about copyright law is that it's not maybe as prescriptive as we'd like it to be, in the sense of it would be helpful to know exactly when you're breaking the law and when you're not. If you're a library, I mean, one thing these lawsuits are doing is establishing clear guidelines for libraries. So now with a decision like this, we know that the creation of a search index is a transformative use under the first fair use factor. So I hope that there are more lawsuits like this that come out properly, just because the more of them there are that get decided the way we want them to, the more it becomes clear in law what's allowable and what's not.
And do we know, is this decision, I mean, because the HathiTrust case and collection, in fact, is so closely tied to the Google case and collection, do we think that this decision is going to have effects on that Google case? I don't think I've read anything about that, but
go ahead, Amanda.
Just one of the things that that I noticed about this decision was that this judge, Judge Bearer, did, I believe, say that he thought the Authors Guild did not have standing to sue, which I thought was interesting. He said only the individual copyright holders can object to HathiTrust copying of these works. And that, it'd be nice to think that that precedent would affect the Google case, but I'm not sure that it will.
Right, right. And what does this mean for HathiTrust moving forward? What are they going to be able to do or continue to do that that maybe they wouldn't have been able to do without this decision? Dan?
Yeah, well, I mean, I still think, again, in comparison to Google, they're really not put in a position where they can, for instance, expose all 7 million books they have to the general public, for instance. In fact, they've never done that, right? So one of the big differences with Google Books is, you know, HathiTrust doesn't in fact, doesn't even show snippets to the general public. And organizationally, you know, they are organized as a nonprofit entity. And so, you know, on many other pieces of fair use, right, they have a different profile than Google in general. Although certainly, as has been noted, you know, there's an overlap because a huge chunk of what's in HathiTrust comes from the Google Scanning project. What I think this liberates them to do is to explore additional scholarly uses. So the so-called research corpus, or the mass of text that was that the people had hoped for in the original Google settlement, if we can think back a few years, that was proposed, where one of the things that Google would do would be to set up research centers where people could text mine millions of books. Well, you know, now that really is going to happen with just HathiTrust, and there will be, I believe, a HathiTrust sort of, you know, perhaps virtual research center, a way to get access to all these books, including those that are in copyright, because the judge has specified that this is an appropriate use and a transformative use, right? That keyword, transformative use of the text. You know, beyond that, I think what it opens up is that, you know, additional universities will feel free to join HathiTrust and to sort of buy in as a membership into this nonprofit. And so a place like Mason, which only has 1.5 million volumes now, might be able to get access to a much larger digitized library. You know, I think they can kind of continue to push forward and make this this very valuable set, this collection of millions of books, available sort of more widely, again, with the restrictions on, you know, scholarly use and I suspect continued gating of some kind. I think it remains to be seen what could be done to make some of this publicly available.
Yeah, can I just mention, I've been doing some research for a project recently, like actual scholarly research, you know, who'd have thought, but using HathiTrust for that, and really striking me afresh how limited really HathiTrust is in terms of sharing full texts of stuff. It's a wonderful, wonderful research resource. But this research that I'm doing is actually in the 19th century. It's with a lot of the same sources I was looking at in my dissertation, you know, 19th century French poetic manuals, and ones in English too. And these things are clearly in the public domain, but HathiTrust doesn't let you download the whole thing. You can read the whole thing online, but you can't get the PDF of the whole thing unless you're a partner with HathiTrust, which Mason is not. And I was finding that very, very frustrating. It's like, ooh, I would really like to download the whole book, and I'm not able to. So if that's true, Dan, that other institutions like Mason will be able to join HathiTrust, I hope that comes to pass.
Right. Well, what I think it mainly does is you have general counsels at these big institutions like ours who are, you know, skittish about joining an organization like HathiTrust that is a magnet for lawsuits. And I think what this does, because it was just such a slam dunk, is that a judge has recognized, you know, fully, completely that this is an enterprise in the service of scholarship, and that it's doing transformative things. And I just think that helps all of us really looking forward.
Well, really a piece of fantastic news for us in this otherwise stormy week when Sandy hit all of us on the East Coast. So other news in the world of academic libraries and digital humanities. We saw that ORCID, the Open Researcher and Contributor ID Project, launched its registry in the last couple of weeks. This is a way to solve the problem of name disambiguation among researchers. So this is, it allows for researchers to sign up for a unique personal identifier, which will attach to all of the researchers' scholarly products, so that I assume, Dan, there's more than one academic named Dan Cohen out there. Is that right?
There are so many that when I published my first book, they had to come back to me 3 times to keep modifying my name. You know, first getting a middle initial, and then my full middle name, and then my birth year, so that they could get a complete record that would be disambiguous, if that's the word, from other of the many Dan Coens in the world.
Well, so this is, so ORCID, I think, is an attempt to provide an open system, a system, that all of the publishers, all of the scholarly community can buy into to solve just that kind of problem. Amanda, you've been following this. What do you think of this initial launch of ORCID?
I think in general, it's a good idea. And I signed up for an ORCID account. I'm a little concerned that, you know, it's going to be the same problem that libraries have with institutional repositories, where they want to get researchers to upload, you know, drafts and preprints of their own articles so that they can, you know, have free access to them instead of paying for journals where they're published. But, you know, the problem that those institutional repositories have, I think ORCID is going to face too, which is that, you know, it requires some effort. Like, you have to sign up for ORCID and you have to give it your data. And I'm not entirely convinced that everybody's going to see the value of that immediately. Because, you know, what value do you get by giving your, you know, all this information? You have to manually fill out, like, your affiliation. You have to manually fill out, like, what works you've published and so on. Now I've explored ORCID a little bit, and it does have a way for you to grant permission to an organization. So I can imagine the history department, for instance, assigning a staff member to kind of keep this kind of stuff updated. But, you know, that's a big job. So I'm hoping that the ORCID, you know, software basically gets a few aggregation methods. I mean, if it had any kind of link to academia.edu, where I think a lot of people have actually put up profiles. So Taro has a CV function, which is this same kind of thing. Linking to other places where this data is stored would be a really good thing. Google Scholar profiles, for instance, you know, there's lots of places where some of this data is, and there's no easy way to transfer the data between those systems now, as far as I can see.
Mills, have you signed up for an ORCID ID?
I haven't. I need to, probably, just because, but I'm with Amanda. I mean, I don't have the time right now to do all of that. Maybe, you know, next semester when I'm not an administrator anymore, but not that I'm counting the days or anything, but I'm with Amanda. The more automatic this kind of thing can be, the better. I do, however, like the idea that there is, that, you know, you have your own unique digital ID number. And I had some of the same problems that Dan had, when publishing originally, you know, because you have to get the name right the first time, because that's how the Library of Congress will remember you forever.
I should mention that there is one import thing. It imports from an Elsevier product called Scopus, but that's just your publications, and that's only if Scopus knows about them. So there is a way to import some information, but it's fairly limited.
Well, and Lord knows I really want to work closely with Elsevier.
Isn't the idea also that you could, for instance, connect up your blog with your, you know, peer-reviewed publications and things like that? I mean, they are trying to aggregate beyond just straight up traditional article publication, right?
Yes, I mean, that's my that is my impression. That is what I've been told, because I voiced the concern early on, or I've actually voiced it several times with regard to this project, and most recently with the launch, that, you know, what. Where does this leave people who aren't, you know, who are working in academia as technicians, alt-ac types, or in museums and libraries, whose primary products really aren't, you know, peer-reviewed publications, who are working on collaborative projects, who are working on museum exhibitions, who are, you know, are they, do they just, does this kind of, does this just reify a system which excludes the recognition for the contributions of a whole range of scholarly practitioners? That's my worry about it, is that it reifies some of the problems that the current system of recognition has. And so I've been told that, because, Dan, you're right, because you're able to kind of connect it up with other things you've done, that this shouldn't be as much of a problem, but I still sort of think that, you know, it, that ends up being like the service section of your tenure package or the service section of your CV, where it's, you know, it's kind of over to the side and down at the bottom. And so, so that is, that's one of the concerns I have, that as we move into a world where a kind of maybe, or as we hopefully, I think many of us want to move into a world where we get beyond just the journal article and the monograph, where we are doing, you know, new kinds of digital scholarship, that this system kind of solves a problem for the older paradigm, but doesn't deal with some of the problems that, that the newer kinds of quote publications, raise. So, I worry that we're kind of fighting the last battle and not thinking more about the future.
And also I just add, if you're listening and you're interested in ORCID and you go to their homepage right now, don't click the Find Out More link, click the About link, because the Find Out More link takes you back to the page you were on. I'm sure.
That's so meta. I think you're right, Tommy. I mean, the navigation right now, like the way it's organized, it allows you to add affiliations, or will allow you to add affiliations, grants, patents, and works. But works is very, you know, while you probably could add, you know, blog posts and things in there, I think it's pretty much geared toward publications.
And I think there's also, I mean, along these same lines, Amanda, I think that's exactly the problem I'm worried about. And also along these lines, I worry that this kind of problem isn't going to be solved without a significant amount of outreach. I think, you know, that the ORCID will reach it, the scientists and engineers who are probably the primary audience for a project like ORCID. But without a significant amount of outreach, it's going to be hard to get humanists to buy into this. And it's going to be even harder to get sort of alt-act types to buy into something like this.
I will mention that I just read a really great blog post by Melissa Terrace, a noted digital humanities researcher across the pond. And she had a great story on her blog about having her name attached to some publications that she didn't actually write. And this was showing up actually in her Google Scholar profile. And they're basically, you know, drama ensues with both the author of other books by the same publisher as the one who published Melissa Terrace's book, and the publisher itself. You know, there's lots of back and forth, so it's a great story. But basically, I think that anyone who's been through something like that, or been through the kinds of thing that Dan Cohen goes through, will have more motivation to sign up for ORCID, but it'll probably take that kind of event to make it happen.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we'll continue to watch this. I do think, I mean, the idea, is a great one. And the problem of, you know, name disambiguation, is a big one, both with kind of current scholarship and in the historical record. And so trying to work out systems to deal with the problem is an important bit of research. It's moving away from, the academy strictly, and into the world of commercial software and hardware. We saw a big event, a few big events over the past couple of weeks. Probably the one that will, affect and befuddle the largest number of people, is the launch of Windows 8. Microsoft launched its latest version, of Windows, to general release. It's providing a relatively inexpensive upgrade. You know, I think it's like $15, to upgrade from Windows 7 to Windows 8, to the general public. Beta testers have been using it. I've been using it for several months now in a kind of half-baked form, and finally upgraded to the latest version last week. And because I've been using it, I've gotten kind of used to its quirks. But I think I actually loaded it onto an old my wife's computer died, and I loaded it onto an old machine, the beta onto an old machine, just because I didn't have a license number handy for her computer. And and, you know, she was immediately completely confused by this new interface. What have people heard? Have you guys tried? I know you guys are mostly Mac users. Have you looked at Windows 8? Have you tried it yet?
I'd like to, but I haven't.
So let me ask you, Tom. Windows 8 will update on any computer, right? You don't have to have the screen that allows you the touch interface.
No. So what Microsoft is attempting to do is build a kind of unified operating system that will work on any form factor of computing device. So they're trying to sort of make this claim that tablets, phones, PCs, these are all PCs. And so we're going to build one user interface, one operating system for all of these devices. So you load the same copy of Windows 8 onto whatever device you're using. You can't really do it there's only certain hardware, touch hardware, but you load it onto whatever device you're using. And if it has a touch screen, it works with touch. If it has a mouse and keyboard, it works with mouse and keyboard. If it's voice activated, you can use it with voice commands. That's the idea. But they also aren't moving completely to the new interface. There is still a desktop, the old desktop interface kind of lurking in the background. And, sometimes you're in the new touch first, what they're calling touch first interface. And sometimes it shoots you back. If you want to use Microsoft Word, it shoots you back to the old desktop interface. So it can be a little disconcerting, I think, for new users. But it is an interesting experiment I think a big risk that Microsoft's taking to really, for a company that's as big, and has as many, users as Microsoft does, to sort of jump whole hog into this new world of touch first, is quite a development. And I think it'll be interesting to see if campuses, which are still, even though you see lots of MacBook Airs walking around these days, in terms of campus IT, we're still talking about mainly Windows machines. If campus IT will make the switch.
Yeah. That's a question I have is, just the scores, the hundreds of computer lab machines, the little quick email machines that they have in our cafeteria, do they switch over to the new interface? They just leave it on the desktop? I think it kind of gets to deeper questions about change in technology. And, we have to remember that, the mouse desktop environment is now 30 years old, right? I just wonder, at some point, does it just become so ingrained that it's just hard to change it? I mean, I, like you, Tom, I kind of admire Microsoft for trying to make the change, but, at some point, it's just so set in that it's hard to imagine without a change in the actual form, like to a tablet, that you'd be able to make this kind of a switch, particularly in organizations that don't want to have the hassle of walking over every time some student or professor has trouble understanding the new Metro or whatever they're calling it, little tile interface, and just can't find anything, can't figure out how to do their email, et cetera.
Yeah, it is really, it's incredibly bold. It's akin to the auto manufacturers, like abandoning the steering wheel and gear shift. It's like you could imagine a better user interface for the car than steering wheel and gear shift. But like, imagine trying to, sell a car without a steering wheel. That's sort of what they're trying to do.
A friend of mine just bought a new Prius van, and I hadn't been in a Prius for a while, and it doesn't have an ignition or an ignition key. Obviously it has an ignition under the engine, but it just has a button that you press.
Right.
And it's the weirdest thing. It's like, this cannot possibly be, a car. You only press a button to start it. But it's interesting because I have not tried Windows 8, but I've been reading a little bit about it, and just having been teaching, some things about design this week for History 390. What I noticed that people are saying about Windows 8 that is particularly bold is that it's anti-skeuomorphic. That it's very modern in its design, and that they're really almost, the whole concept of tiles is not, as I understand, they're little square movable pieces, but it's not, trying to imitate things in the real world the way even just the desktop and things like that were doing. So I understand that people are really, really liking its design, that it's very modern and very, untethered to old metaphors.
It is beautiful, and it's the kind of thing that you want to love. But once you get used, when you're using it, it does, it is, I have to say, and it's probably 30, you know, my 30 years of using a mouse and a keyboard, it is disconcerting, and it will be interesting to see whether people buy into it or what Microsoft does. Do they stick? Do they release an update that, you know, bypasses the new start screen, the new tiled start screen, and goes straight to the desktop? They've decided not to do that, but maybe if the market
demands
it.
I already saw some tip sheet, you know, it's like, here's how to get your start menu back. You know,
yes.
Like, there are hacks. There are hacks.
It's been out for a week, and I've seen at least a half a dozen, applications, third-party applications that, you know, give you your start menu back or bypass the start screen when you go immediately to the desktop when you boot.
Can I get to the DOS prompt? That's what I want to know.
You can, actually. And I mean,
oh,
you know,
still there?
Oh yeah, it's all still there. I mean, the registry is still there. Everything is still there.
It's like archaeological layers of Windows.
It is. It really is. There's, you know, it's, they've never, I mean, one of the reasons this is bold is I think that, you know, Microsoft has never abandoned its legacy users. Like, you could have software that was running in the 1980s on DOS. If your organization used, you know, and there is actually, I'm sure there's, you know, big, you know, industrial companies have software that was written in the 1980s that runs on DOS, and that's still, you know, it still works on the latest version of Windows. And that's still true. So this is ingrained in Microsoft's, you know, in their business model and in their design mindset that, you know, we never abandon a legacy user. And they're not really abandoning legacy users, but they're doing everything but abandoning them with this new design. So it will be interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, I like the modern look actually of that Metro interface on their phone software and on this new OS. And it is interesting that just before we started this podcast, you know, there was this news that, at Apple, the, Scott Forstall, who was the biggest proponent along with Steve Jobs of skeuomorphism, of this notion of, you know, if you have a calendar app, it should have, faux leather trim around the side because that's what, calendars look like on corporate desks in the 1950s, right? And the fact that Johnny Ives, who is a modernist, right, that he worships mid-century modern designers like Dieter Rams and others, I think portends that Apple is going to move much more into this kind of linear tile Mondrian kind of artwork feel. And maybe that will help out Microsoft in the long run to make this transition if Apple, too, moves away from this very long-standing kind of plush desktop, you know, with a literally something that looks like a trash can icon for the trash and things like that. If everything gets moved into something that looks a little bit more modern, maybe it'll be a little bit easier across the board.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I haven't done yet is I haven't used Windows 8 on a touch device. And we saw too that with the launch of Windows 8, Microsoft released also Windows RT, which is their ARM, you know, Windows for ARM, for tablets, for more touch oriented, mobile oriented devices. And they released this Surface tablet, which I think we've talked about, before on the podcast. And, you know, and it's been, you know, it's gotten mixed reviews. I mean, one of the criticisms is there's not enough apps, which, you know, of course there aren't. It was just released. It's gotten kind of mixed reviews. But it will be interesting to see, what it is like to use this new operating system in a touch first environment. So I think we'll see. Well, leaving it there, I think before we close, the thing that my Twitter stream, was most other than Sandy, the Superstorm Sandy. The thing my Twitter stream was most concerned with over the last couple of days, you know, it has nothing to do with Hathi Trust, nothing to do with Orchid, nothing to do with Microsoft or the new iPad mini, which we didn't have a chance to talk about. But it was most concerned with Star Wars Episode 7. So I'm going to get a quick poll from you
Lord.
Guys. Quick poll from you guys. how do we feel? So if for people who didn't hear this, which just kind of rippled like an earthquake through the geek world. George Lucas sold the Star Wars franchise to Disney, and they're going to be making a Star Wars Episode 7, I guess, whatever happens, the story post Return of the Jedi. People happy about this? Will people see the new movie?
Did you see that Disney's stock went down after the acquisition?
Interesting.
I thought that was quite amazing. You know, it slipped quite a bit, actually.
Amanda, will you see this new film?
I'm not sure. I didn't see, I think I saw the first one of the, I don't even know what to call them, you know, the post trilogy.
Right, right.
I saw the first one of those, and I don't think I saw either of the other two.
So maybe.
It depends.
Dan?
Oh, you know, sure. I'll see it. I after that news came out, I tweeted to a website where we can include it in the links. I think it's a free download and also available on iTunes, but there's this kind of comical band for kids called the Board of Education that has a song called Why Is Dad So Mad About Star Wars? And it's sort of this song about, dad's about my age, who, you know, grew up with Star Wars, you know, really intensely, like remember even the, you know, going to the theater for the first Star Wars and being blown away. And then the just like, you know, tremendous feeling of disappointment when Star Wars Episode 1 came out, and the song is about sort of trying to explain that to a little kid who, you know, is viewing everything for the first time and thinks probably Episode 1 is fine, and there's this great like sort of chorus moment where the singer of the Board of Education says, the original Star Wars, he says, you know, it's too late for me, son. It's too late for me, son. And that's kind of how I'm feeling right now. Like it's too late for me, you know, like I just can't imagine that I would like Episode 7.
Mills?
You know, I think I will probably go, but I will just hope that they hire Weird Al Yankovic to do some of the soundtrack. Because if you haven't heard his send up of American Pie, but it's about Darth Vader. and I won't sing it for our listeners because this would be the end of the podcast, but you should just find Weird Al Yankovic's version of American Pie about Darth Vader. And then you will know why I hope that Disney contracts him to do some of the soundtrack for Episode 7.
Well, I think I will probably see it too. I think, you know, the general feeling in my Twitter stream was outrage of the kind that Dan described. But I probably will see it too. Well, if you have any thoughts on Star Wars or any of the other stories that we have covered this week, feel free to email us at feedback@digitalcampus.tv. We'll be back in a couple of more weeks. For Dan, Amanda, and Mills, I'm Tom Scheinfeld. See you soon.
We have to fear is fear itself, fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.